Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome. My name is Larry Kramer. I'm the President and Vice Chancellor here at LSE, and it's my privilege to welcome both our live audience and those who are joining us online to this very special event being hosted by the Phelan United States Center. So in 1999, Larry Lessig published a book entitled Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. It was a sensation. Among other things, it led to the creation of a whole new field of legal discourse and analysis, cyber law, which didn't exist at the time. But that isn't actually why the book was, and I think justifiably, such a sensation and considered so important. Code was published during the kind of halcyon early days of the internet, when it was thought to be a place that didn't have rules and it didn't have government. It was a beautiful, anarchic free-for-all, beyond the bounds of government interference, a libertarian paradise and a new frontier in which the absence of regulation and intermediation would create a new kind of freedom. Some of you are chuckling, but that was so seriously taken, I can't even begin to convey. So Larry changed that. Larry showed how this was not remotely true. In fact, the internet is as hidebound and as rule-bound as anything else, different only because of its fundamental nature, so we didn't necessarily see it. So whether it's technological constraints and rules, the basic protocols, right, that govern the functioning of data transfer, to how domain names are assigned, or what activity has been criminalized, hacking, child pornography, and the like, the internet was, from the very beginning, something that was regulated both within and without. Moreover, those regulations about how to configure the physical nature of the internet and how to make it usable are anything Larry showed but value neutral. Right? They both embody and shape values. They construct options and decisions in ways that limit our choices, limits that often seemed invisible to us. So now we're looking at the advent of yet another new technology, generative artificial intelligence, which has the potential to be still more disruptive and generative even than the internet itself. Now, it's those of you who may have seen or heard the talk I gave last night will recall I talked, among other things, about democracy, and I talked about artificial intelligence. I argued we're at risk of losing popular government altogether, a product of our increasingly fragmented and fragmenting political communities. And then I talked about it separately, the challenge of AI and its potential for revolutionary change, noting its newness, its rapid evolution, which makes it difficult even to know what shape it's going to take, much less how we might want to deal with that. So tonight, Larry's here to talk about the interaction of these two new developments, right? How is, he wrote me in an email, AI makes already awful institutions of popular government worse, forcing us to rethink some basic elements of democracy. In that sense, then, tonight's talk continues the work Larry started in Code, walking through the implications of technology for values and the choices it forces us to make. And I can't actually think of anyone in the world better to help us think through those issues than Larry Lessig. So I've known Larry a really long time. In my first year of teaching at the University of Chicago, he was a first-year student, and I ended up judging his moot court argument. To say he stood out would actually be a gross understatement. It was, by a large margin, the most impressive performance by a student in any class I've ever taught. Not surprisingly, after that, Larry went on to a stellar career. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, one of the half dozen or so greatest judges in American history, and alongside Oliver Wendell Holmes, one of the two most important American legal thinkers of the second half of the 20th century. And Judge Posner always said that Larry was the smartest law clerk he ever had. That was followed by a modest step down to clerking for Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. And you guys are laughing because you probably think I'm joking that it was a step down, and I'm not. I'm going to stop there on that. And then that was followed by a career as an academic at the University of Chicago, then Harvard, then Stanford when I was dean. Then Larry abandoned me and went back to Harvard, where he's currently the Royal Furman Professor of Law. It would take more time than we actually have here tonight to list Larry's many achievements as an academic, and not just as an academic, but also as a public intellectual. In addition to his work creating the field of cyber law, he created the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford and the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, both leading institutions in their respective spaces. Larry's interests are much more wide-ranging than that, as is his impact. He directed the Edward and Lily Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard. He's a leading constitutional theorist and also a leading democratic theorist and activist. He's argued major cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, worked on constitutions in Eastern Europe, launched impactful activist movements in the democracy space, been featured in documentary films, worked with David Byrne, one of my rock heroes, which I'm hugely jealous of, and on and on. Really, even just focusing on the interesting and unusual things Larry's done, I can't cover it all. So I'm just gonna say, go read his Wikipedia page, which is all a long way of saying just how delighted I am to be able to introduce all of you to this really remarkable person. Larry will talk to us, after which we'll have time for questions and answers from both the live audience and those of you listening online. When we do get to that, I'll ask those of you here in the theater to raise your hand. Someone will bring you a microphone when you're called upon. Give your name and affiliation before posing one short question. Those of you joining online can submit your questions through the Q&A feature at the bottom of the screen. Please also let us know your name and affiliation, and we're particularly keen to hear from students and alumni. And then lastly, for social media users who are following the conversation, the hashtag for today's events is #LSEEvents. That's really creative. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available online as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. And with that, it's my pleasure to turn the stage over to Larry Lessig.
I can't say how grateful I am for that introduction from a dear friend and someone I've admired for my whole legal career, as you've heard. And it's so wonderful to be here and to see this new life that he has, and to promise you that he will be an extraordinary gift to this incredible institution. So I come here because I said I would love to celebrate the fact that though we lost Larry in the States, maybe just in time, given the election that's coming up, it's an extraordinary gain that you have to have this academic as your leader. So I begin with some images that will strike you in one way, but I want you to interpret in a different. These images will strike you as outrageous acts of violence, and they were. But we should recognize that these acts of violence were committed by people who believed something. They believed an election had been stolen. As the Washington Post reported, 70% of Republicans agreed with President Trump's contention that he received more votes than Joe Biden on that day. And the majority of Republicans with college degrees believed that the election was fraudulent. This graph represents what 70% of Republicans would mean. It means 32% of America believe that. But that's not even the most striking feature. This is. Those numbers have not changed in the years since that event. Though there have been studies after studies, efforts to unpack what in fact happened at that election, none of them showing any evidence of fraud sufficient to do anything to the final results. Nonetheless, the public continues to sustain the belief they had 4 years ago. I'm going to suggest we should see why this is new. Richard Nixon, who famously committed acts which led him to be forced out of the White House when he first was in the White House, was loved by Republicans about as much as Donald Trump was, not hated by Democrats as much as Donald Trump was, and the independents were somewhere in the middle. But as Nixon came to the end of his administration, there's a striking change in the popularity of Nixon. And what's striking about that change is that all three lines move at the same rate. His support among Republicans, Democrats, and independents collapses at the same rate. By contrast, this is Donald Trump's approval rating over the whole of his administration. Two impeachments, no change, no statistically significant change from any of these three groups. And I'm going to suggest this is the new normal. As Barack Obama puts it, if you watch Fox News, you're in one reality, and if you read the New York Times, you're in a different reality. a different reality, or we should say, realities. If truth is a function of the chorus, we have multiple choruses here. And the question that is the focus of the talk I want to give tonight is, what makes these different realities possible? How are they constructed? Why are they constructed? And how do they affect the topic of America's democracy? Okay, first, the equation we're going to build has one important variable. We're going to have others, but the first to focus on is the media. And I'm going to start by focusing on the work of this extraordinary academic from Princeton, Marcus Pryor, who in this astonishing book, An Empirical Analysis of the Effect of the Architecture of Media Over the Course of the 20th Century, is able to unpack the relationship between that architecture and the democracy that it empowered. So this is not just the story of post-broadcast democracy, it's the story of broadcast democracy and post-broadcast democracy. And broadcast democracy is democracy that's born with the technology of broadcasting, obviously, where many get to hear at one time the same thing. Now, in the story Pryor tells, all broadcast is important, but television is the most important. In his conception, television changes everything of the character of America's democracy, not just because of the concentration of attention to television. As late as 77, 90% of people reported that they got their news from three television networks. But also because of the addiction that technology produced. It was irresistible. People turned it on and left it on. And it was understandable by the wide range of Americans because it was video. And so therefore deeply egalitarian, meaning more citizens were engaged in mainstream trusted sources telling a story of how the world in America was evolving. A daily lesson by the likes of Walter Cronkite. And in a certain sense, they were forced to watch it because there was nothing else on. All news stations showed their news at the same time. So there was a common understanding, a thick common understanding, and on the basis of that common knowledge, there was increased political engagement. That's Pryor's most important claim. And progress on critical issues across the second half of the 20th century. That's broadcast democracy. Post-broadcast democracy is also triggered by a new technology, the technology of cable. Here's a graph that tries to unpack that. The black bars are the big three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. You see they start with about a 70% penetration in 1985, and it falls down to below 40% by 2002. The white bars are cable penetration, meaning the number of households that have cable technology to enable them to get access to television except in a way other than broadcasting, going from just around 45% in 85 to over 80% by 2002. And the line is the average number of channels on these cable infrastructure sets. So going from about 13 channels to over 100 channels by 2002. And the obvious consequence of all this choice is an incredible fragmentation of audiences. You don't have to watch Walter Cronkite. You instead are, well, he wasn't there in 1985, but you don't have to watch broadcast news. Instead, you can watch the cable, you can watch the History Channel or any of these other hundreds of channels available. And this has a dramatic effect on what people watch. Those who were forced before to watch the news are not forced to watch the news now, and they don't watch the news now. And those who do watch the news are the news junkies, which are partisan junkies. And that changes the business model of the news. Broadcasters can no longer have people like Cronkite hosting the news. They need people like Sean Hannity hosting the news, appealing to the increasingly partisan audiences these broadcasters are playing to. Partisan pays in this world, and more partisan pays more. This is, I think, the scariest graph I'm going to show you. Here's a map of the ideological content of the three main cable networks around 2001. Basically the same. And this is how that grows over the period after 2001. A radical separation with Fox News the most conservative, MSNBC the most, quote, liberal in the American sense. And CNN can't quite figure out where it should be, bouncing between. Okay, now we should recognize how both were driven by business models. Both broadcast democracy and post-broadcast democracy were driven by business models, driven by how they make money. Not independent of the government, broadcast democracy was crafted in the shadow of regulation, of the shadow of threatened regulation. Newt Minow in 1961, just 3 months after becoming the chairman of the FCC, gave an extraordinary speech where he talked about the vast wasteland that was television, and he threatened to withdraw licenses from television stations if they didn't start producing content that was in the public interest. And that threat had an effect. It affected a quid pro quo with the networks and the FCC. The quid pro quo was they could continue to produce commercially vacuous content so long as they also produced content that was substantive, news content that was substantive for the public. And the networks conspired to coordinate so that the cost of doing this was as small as possible by having all shows that were news shows on at the same time, and the same character for these news shows. Shows that aimed right down the middle to tell a story that would not separate Americans but draw them together. Now, I don't want this to sound like I'm describing a golden age. There's plenty that was biased and incomplete in the analysis of that news. There's plenty that they were oblivious to. Gay rights didn't exist in the world of broadcast news. And there was insufficient attention to poverty, and except where race forced itself into the foreground, insufficient consideration of race. But the point was, it was a framework for what Pryor calls broadcast democracy, and it produced a kind of public that could respond to democratic arguments in a particular and progressive way. Post-broadcast democracy is produced essentially at the time when the government's disappearing from the debate. The fragments, these different channels, followed whatever worked for them. And what worked was the creation of these bubbles, these different realities, as Obama puts it. The government doesn't regulate the substance or the obligation of these stations to provide content that's in the public interest. Maybe the government can't regulate. Many believe that the First Amendment, as it's been interpreted, would basically disable the government from doing anything interesting in the context of regulating this content. But the point is that both maximize revenue given the constraints. And so to the question that I started this section with, what makes different realities possible, the first step to an answer is to recognize how fragmentation and the business model it inspires is responsible, in part, for these different realities. Okay, that's point one. This is point two. Second variable we're going to add is AI, but I'm going to start by making 3 points about AI, only the third, which will address the direct arguments of this talk. So the first point about AI is to acknowledge, as we too infrequently do, just how extraordinary this technology will be for humanity. Now, you might say I'm just doing this because I'm afraid of our robot overlords when, in fact, they get a chance to listen to this talk, and I don't want to sound like I'm too down on AI because, of course, the overlord might not be happy about that. But I do think we focus too much of our frustration on private AI and our fears about what private AI will do as it develops essentially now in an unregulated way to try to capture the market and drive towards AGI. I think we also need to talk about the potential of what I'll call public AI. The potential of AI deployed for public purposes, not for purposes of maximizing the shareholder value of private companies. So public AI in the sense of science, the enormous potential that AI has to advance our understanding of science, but I think even more importantly, public administration, making government work well, making the efficiency of government doing its job much, much greater than any of us today could imagine. And I think law too. My dream is that 70% of lawyers lose their job. Now, I make lawyers for a living, so you might think that's crazy, but my point is that if we could radically lower the cost of law and make it more efficient, society would be a richer, more valuable incorporation of the values of rule of law. So I think to recognize the potential of public AI, we need not a Manhattan Project, but something more like the Human Genome Project, where people across the world recognize we need to work openly and collaboratively to building the potential of this AI to serve public needs as well as the private needs that the private market will certainly support. So that's point one. Point two, we need a bigger perspective on AI. So AI speaks about itself as intelligence. It suggests a distinction between artificial and natural intelligence. And in the natural intelligence space, we've crowned ourselves king of the natural order, whether that's justified or not. And artificial intelligence, by contrast, is the intelligence that we make. But I'm with David Runciman in suggesting that we already have, and for a long time now, had artificial intelligence within our society. Not digital AI, let's call it analog AI. Entities or institutions that we create with a purpose that acts in the world instrumentally to advance that purpose. I'm going to call that analog AI. These entities, these institutions are instrumentally rational. So take the state as an analog AI. It has institutions, elections, parliaments, constitutions, for the purpose of some collective end. This was ours, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, blah, blah, blah. We therefore have a state as an analog artificial intelligence devoted to a common good, at least hopefully. Or think about the corporation as an analog AI. It has institutions, boards, management, finance, for the purpose of making money, and in the United States, and crazily, as viewed today at least, the conception is that's the only job of the corporation is to make money. This is a modern and absurd conception of the corporation, but it is what it is. A corporation is an analog artificial intelligence devoted to maximizing, we could say, shareholder values. These are AIs. Their purposes and objectives are advanced by humans working within these institutions. Sometimes they are complementing each other. So a public school bus company and schools have complementing interests. Sometimes they conflict with each other. So the environment and coal-fired power plants conflict with each other. And when they conflict, we tell ourselves a happy story. It goes something like this. Once upon a time, there was, let's say, a beautiful park and a factory, and the factory polluted the park. And so we tell ourselves, the people got together and they organized, let's say, a referendum to say we must clean up that pollution. And they run that referendum and the public votes in favor of it, and magic, the pollution is cleaned up. AIs are competing, the state AI and the corporate AI, and the state AI wins. It's a happy story. In my country, at least, it's also a fantasy. Because in my country, at least, corporations are more effective analog AIs than the government. They can run circles around the government's capability to achieve its objectives. And when they do that, the public's objectives are defeated by the private objectives of the corporations. Indeed, we can think of it something like this. If you think about instrumental rationality on the y-axis and time on the x-axis, humans, we're, you know, pretty instrumentally rational, like we're better than cows, maybe not as good as ants, but the point is, like, we can figure out how to get things done. Then we created the institution of the state, and the state is instrumentally more rational. It has capability of doing things that humans themselves can't do. This is Runciman's great contribution to see the way in which states have time horizons that are way beyond the capacity of humans. And then, through the state, we create corporations. And the corporations, too, are instrumentally rational, and they are more efficiently instrumentally rational than the state. Now, each of these layers aspires to control the layer above it. So humans try to control the state through elections in democracies. The state tries to control the corporations through regulations. But the reality of control is often quite different. In the United States, at least, corporations basically control the state through the way we fund campaigns, which make it so corporations get to call the shots and the state can't act without the approval of the corporations. And of course, the state itself can undermine the idea that it is representative of the people by corrupting the system of representation through, for example, devices like gerrymandering. So the point is, we aspire, and then there's a reality. And this aspiration and reality should remind us of something this Nobel Prize winning godfather of AI, Geoffrey Hinton, has said. He said, "There are very few examples of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing." He's saying that to get you a little bit afraid when you start thinking about these AIs becoming super intelligent. Like, at what point do they say, you're not interesting to me anymore, I'm going to go work on some other interesting part of the world? But we could substitute here instrumentally rational. Very few examples of a more instrumentally rational thing being controlled by a less instrumentally rational thing. That's what this picture tells you. These analog AIs have a capacity and have evinced their success at controlling the AI below them. And then to this we add digital AI. And here again, you have an aspiration to control. Corporations try to control their AIs. And then you have a reality of control. This extraordinary story published in September of 2017, where Facebook was discovered to have advertising categories for, quote, Jew haters. So you could buy ads targeting Jew haters. And Facebook quickly said, look, we didn't write that. That's not our category. And that was true. No human wrote the category Jew haters. Its AI had determined that Jew haters was a profitable category to create and to begin to market to. So even though it said it had control over its AI ran far ahead of its own control. But the real difference when you think about these layers of instrumental rationality is just the relationship of the power between them. Because these are massively instrumentally rational things, AIs, more efficient at achieving their objectives, really any objective it can specify, than are we. And that fact is the most important fact to account for the effect which AI is having in the context of our democracy. Okay, now point three, related to AI and what I promised at the title of this talk. How is AI affecting democracy now? Well, there are two ways. We could describe the intended way, or the way that was intended by the deployers of the AI, and the byproduct way, a way that's not intended, but it just has that effect. So in the intended way, there's a fantastic site that Wired has set up, which is tracking across the 60 countries that have elections this year, all the examples of AI being deployed to interfere with or intervene in that election. And there are some incredibly interesting examples, and I'll tell you, nothing in America is as interesting as AI Steve, which was a candidate that ran for parliament here in Britain. But there are two uses that it's important to isolate in describing what's happening in America that are having an intended effect. The first use is foreign actors sowing dissent or skepticism or cynicism about the American political infrastructure through the deployments of AI. So famous stories of fake Russian news sites claiming Kamala Harris was hit in a hit and run accident. US says Russian bot firms are using AIs to impersonate Americans to make it so they can pretend to be Americans that are spreading content on these social media platforms. China is deploying what's called here spamouflage, but it's actually very similar to the 50 Cent Party in China, which succeeds by flooding the channels of debates with sometimes completely orthogonal, irrelevant other content, but having the effect of undermining the underlying movement that might have been interfered with. This is the one that's most frightening to me. I hadn't known about this before I researched for this talk. So Russian news sites are creating news sites in what we could think of as news deserts in the United States. So you have towns that no longer have a local newspaper. And so they will create a fake news site that relates to that town. And that fake news site will have all sorts of fake news that's being generated by AI to populate it so that the people in those localities will be exposed to this fake pro-Russian information. And the striking thing is There are now just as many fake news sites as there are real news sites in these areas in the United States. So if you're in one of these areas, there's a 50-50 chance you're getting news propaganda from the Soviets when you think you're just looking at your local news site on the web. So those are foreign actors, and they think that's a substantial concern we should keep in view. And then there are domestic actors who are just desperately trying to find a way to use this new technology to achieve what they're trying to achieve. Democrats have been really successful in using AI for the purpose of fundraising, much more effectively than Republicans have, at least in the 2022 cycle. But then there's all sorts of like embarrassing examples. So Donald Trump released an AI image of like Taylor Swift endorsing him. I love the way CNN organized this, because that image is as clearly as, you've got to be kidding me, you would do something like that, because it was just so stupid. Then there are kind of trivial and harmless examples.
Silicon Valley, I learned early on that a creative spark can change the world. I'm Peter Dixon, and I've carried that with me everywhere I've been. It's what brought me to Kenya, where we used youth soccer to combat ethnic violence. After 9/11, I joined the Marine Corps, and I led young men and women in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So maybe that's effective. This is crazy. This is an ad for a local governor's race in Indiana. I'm going to give you the end of it. Okay, now the reason this is significant is you're like looking at this, and most of you probably don't know why this is even there. Like, why would you have no gas stoves? And that's because the right in the United States has created this great fear that what the Democrats will do is, if they're elected, is to ban gas stoves. And so this is like a trigger thing for the right. And so you're like, wow, why would this candidate give a speech where, like, surrounding her is all these people saying, no gas stoves, as if there's a popular movement to ban gas stoves in the United States. But the point is, this is totally fake. All of these signs are fake, AI added to this image. And the ad originally was released without any acknowledgement of this, but if you read at the bottom, it now has an acknowledgement, which would be on the screen for about 1 second of this 30-second ad. So it creates a substantially false impression, but, you know, probably on balance it doesn't do much harm. Then there are these companies that are trying to create cloned versions of candidates. I'm going to play this a little bit hard, but listen to the very beginning, and then I'm going to, and then you'll hear a little bit later in it.
Hi, Evan.
Okay, so what he's saying is he's actually saying, hi, Evan. Like, so this is targeted to a particular voter. So the idea is the AI would generate a particular version for you that would talk about you and the things that you want, but then just listen for the quality here.
Hi, Evan. I'm Greg Happ, and I'm running for Congress. I'm not a politician, and I'm not on the oil and gas company's payroll. And I'm not the wealthy outsider who just moved into the district to run for office. I'm a doer, not a talker. I care deeply about our community, and I'm running for Congress to protect and strengthen.
Can I watch this?
Like you, I care about crime.
Okay, so probably not very effective. Then there are AI sites that are building whole AI tool sets to like run the whole campaign. They have all sorts of power built into this. This is a site that's actually, I think that it's being developed here in London, Civox, which had a particular product which made it possible to have AIs do telephone calls to voters. They could do up to 1,000 calls in 5 minutes. But they discovered that basically everybody hung up within a few seconds of getting the call, because nobody really wants to talk to an AI on the other side. So the point is, if this is what we're talking about when we talk about AI in the elections, at least in the domestic context, I'm not talking about the foreign influence context, then I agree with most who've looked at it to say it's really overblown, our concern about AI now. As the New York Times put it, this was the a year of the AI election that wasn't, meaning we had all sorts of talk about how generative AI would be used to radically change results. We've just not seen it yet. Okay, but, and I asked Dolly to make this for me, it's really beautiful. I then asked Claude to make it. It's not quite so beautiful, but okay. But obviously, this is not where AI is having its effect. Where AI is having its effect is in what I call the byproduct story. Okay, so This is Tristan Harris, who was an engineer at Google and then left Google to start the Center for Humane Technology because he was deeply troubled by what he was observing at that company, and it could have been any of the social media companies, about what they were doing to affect how people used their technology. You might know him from The Social Dilemma, which is one of the most watched documentaries in the history of documentaries talking about social media. But what he focused on was the development and deployment of the science of attention, where technologists learned how to engineer attention to overcome the resistance people might otherwise have to engaging with these platforms. He described it as a kind of brain hacking. So brain hacking, we can understand maybe by comparison to a more familiar example, body hacking. Okay, so this fantastic book by Michael Moss, Salt, Sugar, Fat, describes how the processed food industry created food science, which is the science to engineer food, to exploit evolution, to overcome our natural resistance to overeating so you can't stop eating what they serve you to eat, so that they could sell more food, or maybe quote food, and increase their profit. Now, this is harmless to many people, but for others it's quite significant, because what they've done is basically take through this hacking the control that the body otherwise would have exerted and removed it so that they're vulnerable to the consequences of this kind of food. Brain hacking is the same with respect to attention. It's exploiting evolution, the fact that we react irrationally to random rewards, or we can't resist bottomless pits of content, with the aim to increase engagement with the platform so that they can sell ads. This is the business model, and AI drives it. Tristan refers to this as our first contact with AI. And that business model, engagement, is engaged with what some have called the colonizing of the mind. How many people have heard of Bo Burnham? This is just great. Okay, so here's Bo Burnham talking about this.
We used to colonize land. That was the thing you could expand into, and that's where money was to be made. We colonized the entire earth. There was no other place for the businesses and capitalism to expand into, and then they realized human attention. That we can now, they are now trying to colonize every minute of your life. That is what these people are trying to do. Every single free moment you have is a moment you could be looking at your phone and they could be gathering information to target ads at you. That's what's happening. So like as much as we can, you know, as have really good conversations and try to humanize the conversations, the like mechanism of the business is rolling towards that just because of the market. So like,
you can see he's kind of embarrassed because he's realizing he's at an event he's been invited to by Facebook. So he's sitting on stage with Facebook talking about how Facebook is colonizing the mind, and so is every other social media platform. That business model creates an incentive. As Shoshana Zuboff has so magisterially described, in the age of surveillance capitalism, the incentive is to know more about us, not just by watching us, but by poking us, tweaking us, asking us questions, rendering us vulnerable, reaching down the brain stack to leverage our insecurity so that we reveal more so that they can better sell ads. Okay, now the key here is that in so doing, this business model, and I apologize at the LSE to be invoking a Marshallian concept, this business model imposes externalities on the rest of us and on society. As Zeynep Tufekci puts it, the companies are in the business of monetizing attention, and not necessarily in ways that are conducive to health or success of social movements or the public sphere. Because it just turns out, too bad for us, that the best strategy, the most profitable strategy to drive engagement is the politics of hate. We engage more, the more extreme, the more polarizing, the more hate-filled the content is, and so that's what we're fed. That's what the AI learns to feed us. And the consequence of that dynamic is that this ideal of we the people becomes we the polarized, ignorant, and angry. Democracy is weakened, the bubbles are cemented, the bubbles get built with hate inside. Now, it's important to recognize this is not because AI is so strong, It's because we are so weak. Here's Tristan from The Social Dilemma.
We're all looking out for the moment when technology would overwhelm human strengths and intelligence. When is it going to cross the singularity and replace our job to be smarter than humans? But there's this much earlier moment when technology exceeds and overwhelms human weaknesses. This point being crossed is at the root of addiction, polarization, radicalization, outrageification, vanityification, the entire thing. This is overpowering human nature, and this is checkmate on humanity.
So the point is, like, we typically are like obsessed with this question: when will AGI happen? Like, when will we get to the point where the computers are smarter than us on every dimension of human intelligence? But Tristan's arguing we need to worry about this much earlier than that, not when it's stronger than our strength, but when it overcomes our weakness. And his point in The Social Dilemma was pointing to individual weakness, our individual incapacity to, like, put down our phones, but we should also think about our collective human weakness. The consequence of this technology to disable our collective ability to choose how we should govern ourselves or move forward. It's not just the individual robot that's going to surround the individual, it's also the robots that surround all of us that steer us away from this capacity. This is the AI that we should be focused upon. As AI does this, and will do this better, what it produces is a not-to-be-ignored public, or we should say publics. These not-to-be-ignored publics emerge, and as they emerge, they will have a democratic effect on the capacity of the nation to make democratic choices. On January 6th, after this extraordinary event, there were many Republicans who said something like, "Thank God we're finished with him," imagining that the fact that Donald Trump had triggered a riot or maybe an effort to take over the government would lead everybody to say, "Okay, enough, I'm finished with this man." And then the overnight polls came back and it turned out that the people loved him even more. And so these politicians will openly say in private, "What am I supposed to do? If my base loves him, I must love him too." And of course, there's an impressive list on Wikipedia of all the Republicans who have turned away from Trump. We should recognize that in the United States Senate, these are the only senators, and after next year, these are the only senators who've openly resisted Trump, less than 10% of the Republicans in the Senate. And in the House, it's 1.5% of the Republicans in the House who've openly resisted a man who seeded this insurrection. Okay, so the point is, as a byproduct of the engagement business model, juiced by AI, we produce results that were bad in 2020, will be worse in 2024, and much worse as we push beyond 2024. And that should lead us to ask something I don't think we ask enough. What kind of democracy is actually possible here? With the media, with this business model, what kind of democracy could work? And as depressing as it is to suggest this, but I promise there's a really hopeful story after this, but as depressing as it is to suggest this here, I think we need to accept that the democracy we have right now is not one that we can practice in a world with that media. There is no way to beat this. As far as we can see, there is no way to beat this. This business model against democracy. Yeah. So obviously AI did this poster for me because it can't spell. That's just how smart it is. But this business model devoted to a way of making money that has the effect of weakening democracy. It's a business model against democracy, and it just so happens to be the most important business in a democracy. Okay, so what's to be done in the face of this? So about a decade ago, David von Raybrook published this book, Against Elections, and early in the book, there's a really fantastic passage. He says, "For almost 3,000 years, people have been experimenting with democracy, and only in the last 200 have they practiced it exclusively by holding elections." raising before us a contingency that most of us never noticed was a contingency. The contingency that we select representatives through an election rather than through other processes like sortition processes. And indeed, at the time of the birth of the democratic movements in France and the United States, the dominant theory, Montesquieu echoing Aristotle, was that if you choose representatives through elections, that tends towards aristocracy, and if you choose them through lot, or sortition as we think of it, that tends to democracy. But this reality that we only practice democracy through elections is changing now. Let me tell you some stories. So, 2008, Iceland suffered a financial crisis. They led in the suffering of the financial crisis, and people in Iceland attributed their terrible governmental decisions to the failure of the country to have a genuine and effective constitution. And so the public crowdsourced a process for crafting a new constitution. And the first step was a random representative population of 1,000 people gathered together to identify the values an Iceland constitution should have, which then led to a process of electing people to draft the constitution. 534 people ran for 25 seats using ranked choice voting. They came down to 25 people who spent 4 months drafting a constitution, which is about as long as our framers did, but the framers didn't have Facebook and the internet to help to spread the information to the world as they drafted it. And they produced a constitution, a beautiful, short constitution, which then was sent out to referendum, and the question was, should the parliament draft a constitution based on this draft? More than two-thirds of those voting said yes. Then the parliament ignored it, and nothing has happened to it. But the point is, it was a process that was random, representative, informed, and deliberated, and in an important sense, protected in their work from distractions or distortions produced by the media that might otherwise surround what they did. Or think about Ireland, which I'm sure is familiar to many people here. Ireland, at the same time, began a process of convening citizen assemblies. They're much smaller, just 100. Originally, a third of them were representatives, and now they've changed that. Those citizen assemblies, randomly selected, take on seriously difficult problems, which it's clear the Irish Parliament wouldn't have the capacity to address. So two of the issues they addressed were gay marriage and abortion, issues which, because of the influence of the Catholic Church in the Parliament, could not have been addressed by the Parliament in a similarly independent way. And in that process, they recommended deregulation of abortion and approval of same-sex marriage, and then those ideas were taken out to the public in referendum, and the public supported them at a higher percentage than they were supported inside the citizen assembly. And they've done this basically every year since the launch of this after 2008. And so once again, it's a process that's random, representative, informed. They spend an enormous amount of time understanding the issue that they're deliberating on, and then deliberate it. People talk to each other to understand their position, protected in that process from the influences on the outside. France is another famous example. A decade ago, when a socialist member of parliament suggested citizen assemblies as part of the French process of democracy, every party signed a document that said citizen assemblies were a betrayal of the idea of representative democracy and they would never happen in France. Now candidates for president running for president in France, like Macron, promise citizen assemblies as part of their platform. And the first most prominent one was a citizen assembly around the questions of climate, where 150 randomly selected citizens spent 9 months in 7 sessions deliberating on what France should do around the questions of climate change and produced a report that has had a substantial effect on how France develops their policy. Once again, random, representative, informed, and deliberated, and protected from the outside process. Germany is doing something similar. I think the most dramatic example for me is from this place. You might not recognize it. Many of us haven't been there, but I went there. This is Mongolia. This is a picture, not a painting, of Mongolia. This is a picture of Mongolia in the sense that John Adams said that the legislature would be the public in miniature. This is a random representative sample of Mongolia, representative of wealth, so high income, low income, profession, where they live and sex. There's a little bit too many women there, but that's probably not a bad thing. But the point is 750 randomly selected Mongolians were brought together to consider amendments to the Mongolian constitution because, for reasons that take too long to explain, the Mongolian constitution has this bizarre provision that says before you are allowed to consider an amendment, the parliament, they have to send it out to a deliberative poll or what I'm referring to here as a citizen assembly. So I went there in April of 2017 and I got to watch as they did this and listen through translations as they met in big groups and also in small groups to deliberate on this. I was convinced as a constitutional law professor they could never do this. It's like too hard for like normal people to sit down and work through, but it turns out constitutional law is not rocket science and what they produced was seriously good judgment about which provision made sense and which didn't through this random, representative, informed, and deliberative process protected from outside influences that would otherwise corrupt it. This is the citizen assembly movement. Its objective is not to replace elected government, so it's not technically against elections. Its objective is to complement the work of elected government by adding something, a protected democratic will, protected from the crazy, from the distracted, from the destructive. Now recognize how law already does this when law calls on a much worse version of a random group of people to help the law decide what to do. The deliberations of a jury are in a similar way protected. The judge decides what information they get. They give them a chance to deliberate. They have to face each other as they make their judgment. But a citizen assembly is better than a jury because, of course, a jury is not representative. It's not large enough to be statistically significant. A citizen assembly is to be as big as it needs to be statistically significant. But the protection of that process is just as necessary as it is in the context of a jury. Because in a certain important way, we should recognize that the promise of representative democracy has been distorted and corrupted both. So if the idea was we the people would, through elections, select a representative body to represent us, it's been distorted, as I've described, through the business model of media to pull us apart in ways that are artificial relative to who we are, and has been corrupted, in the United States at least, through the influence of money inside of the representative process. A citizen assembly both tries to remove that distortion, allowing people to live not separated but together, and also to remove this corruption, at least for the some who participate in those processes. And if those some can stand for all, then we begin to have an extraordinarily transformative opportunity for the idea of democratic representation. Now, I think that's the most important innovations that are happening anywhere in democratic work. It's the only magic in democracy space right now in the sense that when people participate in it, they walk out saying, oh my God, I've never imagined an experience like this. Not the kind of horrible, let's go listen to a debate and people scream at each other or force people to go out and vote, but a process that convinces people that people are capable of making judgments, democratic judgments that are worthy and valuable. There are hundreds of these happening across the world. There's even a movement. I think Helene is the philosopher leading the movement. I think Claudia is the activist leading the movement. But obviously, I think we need this more and everywhere. And, or maybe you should say, but, here's the point I want to add. It's not because this is a good idea, or not just because this is a good idea. We need this innovation because I think it's existential for democracy. This is a change not just to make democracy better, it's a change to allow democracy to survive. Because as engagement profits, we lose faith in our democracy. This is the most terrifying study that Pew does, at least from my perspective. Starting in 1997, Pew began to ask the question, percentages who say that they have trust and confidence in the wisdom of American people making political judgments. This is a question asked of Americans, not of you. Okay, so this is Americans judging whether Americans have confidence in their own political judgment. And in 1997, two-thirds of Americans said yes, hell yes, that's what they said. Hell yes, we're good at making political judgments. Here's how those graphs have changed over time. Obviously, we've lost confidence in ourselves, and why wouldn't we as the infrastructure of media feeds us this crazy all the time. Who could believe in the people when we see the people behaving, regardless of the side you're on, in ways that are told to us are just insane? Okay, one more thought before I stop. I tried to get you to focus not on technology, and not even on the media, but focus on a business model. The business model is the model of engagement, a model that profits from colonizing attention, the one resource you have that is most valuable to you. We need to begin to adopt a perspective that looks at this system together and just asks a very obvious LSE question. Is the benefit of that system worth the costs? If the costs are jeopardizing democracy, are there many causes that I would think could plausibly justify just jeopardizing democracy? If you told me you were jeopardizing democracy to end climate change, I wouldn't support you, but I would get it. I would get that argument. Or if you told me you were jeopardizing democracy in order to end world hunger, again, I wouldn't support you, but I'd get the point. I'd see why that was so important and why it could possibly justify jeopardizing democracy. But when you tell me you're jeopardizing democracy so that Mark can get richer, I just don't get it. I don't know what you're talking about anymore. The idea that we are putting our whole infrastructure of self-government at risk because we've thrown ourselves open over to the model of engagement is literally insane. And so just to drop a bomb before I end, let me just say what we need to do is to blow up the engagement model, to blow up the engagement business model and make it no longer a force that is tearing us apart individually and us apart as a society. Thank you so much for...
See what I mean? That was great. And also, I've seen Larry do that with slides. I've never used a slide in my life. I'm so jealous. We have time for questions and answers. I'm going to just, and to model this for you because we want them to be short, I'm going to ask two very quick, short questions, and then we'll go to you guys and to online. So first, quick, short question. You talk about broadcast democracy and post-broadcast democracy, and the challenge is that post-broadcast democracy fragments. People get exposed to crazy information that stokes hate, et cetera. So talk to me a little about how pre-broadcast democracy worked then when the media environment was exactly the same.
Yeah, so if you think about the time before broadcasting and you look at the media as you've studied and as I've studied, the media was very similar. It's very partisan, very fractured, very polarizing. The big difference is the public was not legible. There was no way to see the public in like Washington or in London. You wouldn't see it directly every single moment. James Bryce wrote this extraordinary work called The American Commonwealth in the late part. It's kind of the echo of de Tocqueville, but in the late part of the 19th century. And he fantasizes about a world where you could push a button at any time and know what the public thought. That would be the final stage, he said, of democracy. That would be a disaster, I think, for democracy, because the point is, if what you're seeing is this extremely fractionated public, then policymakers are no longer free, or wouldn't have been free, to make a judgment based on what they thought made sense. And so that's not to diss the public. It's just to say the public's got a lot going on in their life, and their job isn't to sit down and work through policy all the time. And so in a world where they don't have this kind of weird education that happened during broadcast democracy, it's not surprising they would be then much like they are now. But here's one big difference. Though this business model is similar in the sense that, you know, a Republican paper or a Democratic paper would have been pushing hard to advance the Republican cause or advance the Democratic cause, so they had an objective to raise the love for their own side and the hatred for the other side. The technology was radically less efficient because the point I'm making is it's the AI that is learning how best to treat you, to get you to the place it wants to get you. It's like learning, you know, all of you have experienced TikTok and had this like, oh my God, how did it know I wanted to see that? Like, how did it know that? Well, because its capacity is way beyond our capacity to even understand what's happening. And so the difference between the two is just the fact that today this amplification of crazy is much more effective than it would have been then.
So basically, policymakers used to have the freedom to ignore the people.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine and fair. I agree. Second question, short one. Okay, if you pose it at the end that we have this problem because there is this business model and we need to make some kind of radical change, the assumption is, though, that the business model we can't change. We have to change our democracy around it, as opposed to just changing the business model. And this goes to, I mean, what for me has always been a puzzle, which is for some reason, when it comes to any other technology, we assume that if it does bad things, we can regulate, make it illegal, do all the things that we need to. But when it comes to information technology, somehow if it can do something, we're stuck with it, and then we have to contort the rest of our world around it. So why not just say, yeah, you're right, the business model, let's change that. It won't take more effort than it's going to take to create a whole new democracy.
No, I think we should. And one of the problems is people are like, well, what could you do? And, you know, if you say, let's ban social media, of course, people are like, that's crazy. You're never going to ban social media. And in the United States, anything they do is almost immediately threatened by the First Amendment. They just had a law passed in California to ban deepfakes. And the day it went into effect, a district court judge enjoined it, saying that it regulates political speech, and therefore you need a compelling state interest. And the question is whether there's a less restrictive way of achieving your objective. And the answer was counter speech. So you had a deep fake out there. The answer to a deep fake out there is to have something out there that says, oh, that's a deep fake, as if that would be effective at all. But that's the framework of American First Amendment law. But look, there's a very easy way to do it. I'm going to use a word which in Washington you can't use. But here I imagine we can use that word. It's tax. Okay? Let's imagine an engagement or maybe an intention tax. And let's say it's a quadratic tax so that one, I don't know what the units are and I don't know what the size is, but whatever they are, at one, it's one, at two, it's four, at three, it's six, at four, and so forth. So that the tax is going up, the more you engage. And at a certain point, Facebook would be like, yeah, and it's still called Facebook. Facebook would be like, could you like go take a walk maybe because you're costing us more than you're earning us, right? So you immediately make it so that the platforms are not trying to do what Bo Burnham was describing, finding a way to get every single minute because they know at a certain point the minutes are not worth it. So they have to figure out a new business model. I mean, why isn't that the most obvious response? But what's so striking to me is that people, as you say, can't begin to imagine a response to deal with this technology, which nobody ever planned to have the effect that it actually has.
Okay, so let's go to the, where are the microphone people? One, is there somebody on this? Okay, great. Where do I, so many people to choose from. Let's start over there and then over there. So we'll do two over here. And we'll do both, I guess. I am going to bunch a little. Okay. So we'll do both the questions.
Hi, okay. My name is Richard Johnson. I'm a lecturer at Queen Mary, University of London. So I guess you're trying to discern the public will, and you see elections as distorting of the public will, and you see random sampling as a way of getting a more accurate read of the public will. But citizens' assemblies surely are still open to distortion from outside and inside. And taking the logic of your argument possibly to an absurd extreme, aren't you advocating a system that could also be achieved by having a dictator who follows YouGov polls, which also use random sampling to find out what the public view is?
Okay, hold off on that. Just turn around and give it hello. Okay.
My question might be a bit more logistical one than a thought experiment. I'm Sophia, I'm a student at the University of Virginia, and I was just wondering, going back to what Professor Kramer was saying about changing the business model. From what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, but currently under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, social media companies can't really be held liable for any of the content on their sites. Is there a way to amend that without breaching First Amendment protections?
So let me take the second one first. Yes, there is. You can just remove the immunity. And what the removing the immunity would mean is that if you have something that's defamatory or destructive in a certain way, then the company would have an immediate incentive to do something, at least if they're notified about it. And I'm all in favor of like finding ways to tweak 230 to make it much more responsive so that harm is not done like that. But the point to see is that that doesn't solve the problem. That's like a tiny slice of the problem. It's like people who think that the problem is misinformation are just missing the fact that even if it were all true information, the AI would find a way to drive you to your corner, even with true information. It's that good. So we could solve misinformation, and we should. And we could solve the incentive problems of massive harm that's produced, and I think we should. But we should not think that that's going to solve the problem I'm describing. And then in response to the polling question, so I'm not talking about polls. I'm talking about deliberation from a population that is random and representative. So it's like a poll in that it's random and representative, but the process is not just asking them what they think. The process is giving them a brace of information, which they then have time to consume individually and then together in a group, and they work on that together, and then they come out with a view in the end about how they think about the issue. This is a process that's been perfected for the last 30 plus years, maybe more now, by Jim Fishkin at Stanford. He calls it deliberative polling. But the point is, and it's a very complicated process to do it right. So to respond to the beginning of your question, you're right. You need to be very careful to make sure you've got the right set of information. It's got to be viewed as fair and balanced. And in a certain sense, you've got to protect the group deliberating from other information that might try to get in. Now, you're right to say, like, well, won't they just find a way to manipulate that? You'd say the same thing about juries. I mean, we have a lot of infrastructure to protect juries from manipulation, and the incentives to manipulate are much stronger in the context of a jury. And, in most places beyond Chicago, we're pretty good at, like, making sure the juries are not manipulated in this particular way. And that we have to worry about the same thing there. I'm not describing this as an easy fix. I'm describing it as a fix. It will be hard. And again, I don't want everything to be decided by a citizen assembly, but a citizen assembly could begin to push democracies in a direction. We know the democracy won't go. That's what Ireland discovered when all of a sudden gay people could get married and women had the right to choose whether to terminate their pregnancy or not.
So give me a question online.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you. Just to say, there are folks joining us online tonight from the US, Ireland, Italy, Turkey, Argentina, Bangladesh, Hungary, Canada, France, Nigeria, Germany, and Greece, and other countries as well. So the first question from online comes from Aliyah. Hi, how do we use AI or any other way to flag or identify AI-generated misinformation? Thank you.
So AI is getting pretty good at that. And again, like if I thought that the only problem was misinformation, I'd be pretty confident that we're going to get to a place where AI is pretty good at finding that and filtering it out. But again, I don't think misinformation alone, fixing misinformation alone, changes the business model. And there are ways to maximize engagement on the business model even without deploying misinformation. So it might be a little more boring without the misinformation, because the misinformation is really fun, but it still would have an effect. Now, again, I don't want to minimize the significance of this. The other astonishing statistic beyond the one I showed you about the percentage of Republicans who believe that the election was stolen is that a majority of Republicans, I hope this means something here, believe they're eating cats and dogs in Springfield. Actually believe they're eating cats and dogs in Springfield. You know, and so obviously, the information ecosystem, these are not stupid people. I mean, it's easy for people on the left to just think these are stupid people. And of course, it's their identity, so they're not really willing to question much of it. But the point is, there's something wrong with the infrastructure of information if such a substantial number of people could be led to believe what we all know is just crazy talk.
So let's do some in the middle section now. So here and then there. You might as well give him the microphone now. So you'll go after her, though.
Hi, I'm Caitlin, and I'm an alumni of the University of Virginia and Peking University. I was wondering...
A lot of Virginians here, for some reason.
I was wondering, because you made the linkage between polarization of American society being exponentially increased through the use of AI in this business model, if there ever were to be kind of this regulation that stops this business model from being so efficient and so successful in doing that, what does the depolarization process of American society look like?
Yeah, great question.
Here, let's get both questions.
Oh, sorry.
My question's in a similar vein. My name is Sid. I'm an exchange student here at LSE. My home institution is the George Washington University out in D.C.
Anybody here from LSE? Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
In kind of a similar vein, and I hate to ask this, but the impending question is the election, and it is how will 2024 impact not just the next 4 years, but the sort of outlook of the United States. I guess, in your view, how will the outcome of the election impact our ability to make these sort of large-scale changes? Is it something that no matter who becomes president come November will be able to be done in like future administrations, or will this be the election that really does determine the outcome of democracy as a whole?
So first on the depolarization point, it's a great and helpful question, because I want to make sure that I'm not heard to be saying that it's only social media that's causing polarization in America. There's so many things, unfortunately, that work together to drive polarization, including what we call sorting, right? So it turns out people have moved to places which are increasingly their own identity, and so that also drives polarization. So there are many things to point to, and flipping off the engagement model won't bring us back to whatever period you want to dream about getting back to. But I think it also emphasizes that there's a lot of work to be done to get us to a place where we can actually function as a democratic society well. And I think we've started a project to produce, we have a platform which is a virtual deliberation platform, which we are going to open source and make available extremely cheaply all around the world. Because I think exercising the muscle of deliberation is a critical part of like restoring something of citizenship. And then we ought to have every context, not just about politics, but every context of education and public life ought to include the experience of like sitting down with people you don't agree with and learning how to talk to them. And it's a surprisingly edifying experience if done well, because it turns out the other side are not lizards. They actually have families or kids. They have the same dreams you do. They just have different views. And you need to learn to talk to them. And it's extremely hard, especially in universities in America right now with students, it's extremely hard to make it possible for people to do that. And I think that's just because we don't do it. And we've got to find a way to do it more consistently. I don't know how to respond fairly to the second question, because let me just confess, I think this is a catastrophically important election. And like the world looks radically different depending on which result happens. And if I had to bet today, I would not bet that my side's going to win. What we know about AI regulation is that the Trump administration would totally roll back everything the Biden administration has done and basically has committed to the extent that people inside the administration have been, the future administration have been identified, to a complete laissez-faire view about AI, which is astonishing, because nobody says we should be laissez-faire about airplanes. Like, we don't say, let's make airplanes, but there should be no safety regulation around airplanes, because that violates a stupid view of Adam Smith, right? I mean, nobody has any conception of important projects that should be free of regulation in general, yet that's a strong view that exists in Silicon Valley about AI. And so I think if there is a new Trump administration, that's an enormously important problem. And I also think on the Harris administration has a lot of people, I know them, who are very keen to try to think through these problems in a constructive way. But I don't think either administration would ever have the courage to utter the word engagement tax, or even worse, quadratic engagement tax, right? Those are words that just don't come out of the mouth of American politicians. And so we need other countries to do it first, and then we'll learn that maybe it's a good thing to try.
And note, that was a stupid view of Adam Smith. Just in fairness to Adam Smith, he would have not have said that either. Let's get another question from...
You have the far right over here, you forgot.
I know, that's next. So this is back to the online.
Oh, I see.
So this question comes from Montessor Ali. How can AI reshape democratic processes, and what risks does it pose to voter autonomy and the fairness of elections in an increasingly automated society?
So here's where the AI that I've said is not having a significant effect does raise really hard ethical questions. So there's a really great researcher, Pennycock, who's been doing work demonstrating how chatbots can have significant effect on people's views. They've been deploying chatbots to de-radicalize conspiracy theorists. And like if conspiracy theorists sit down and they start talking to a chatbot, they will walk out of the conversation having non-conspiracy views, and those non-conspiracy views stick for at least 4 months. It's a pretty substantial and amazing result. And it's kind of like interesting it would have that effect, but not too surprising, because if you're dealing with another person, your ego is triggered, right? So if I'm arguing with you to try to convince you that in fact 9/11 was not an inside job, you're losing to me to the extent you agree with me. So you're not going to agree with me. But if it's a chatbot, who cares? You're just talking to it and it's like helping you work through this. Okay, so that doesn't sound terrible. But I know there are people experimenting with the idea of chatbots being deployed for the purpose of persuading people on elections or not. And indeed, I was with one of the leading scientists at Anthropic, and he said to me, the thing he is most afraid of about AI is that it will be too persuasive. And from a constitutional perspective, to say it's too persuasive is to say there's nothing you can do to regulate it, because if the thing it's doing is being persuasive, that's what speech is supposed to be about. So what are you supposed to say? You're not allowed to be persuaded by this machine? We're going to block the machine from persuading you? There you might say, there I think we don't know how to answer the question, is that helping the democratic process or not? Especially because it's not as if the machine knows what the truth is. The machine is just being deployed for a particular purpose. I want you to convince these Trump voters to vote for Harris, or I want you to convince these Trump voters not to show up, or I want you to vote to convince these Harris voters that they should vote for Jill Stein because the Green Party is actually the savior for America. You know, all of these are possible moves, and the technology will get very good at doing all of that. And what do we do when we begin to believe that all of us have been basically, if we could use the word manipulated, we would have a way to deal with it, but manipulated by machines that are just better able at us than us at tricking us into doing what it wants us to do.
So, and as Larry said, we have ignored the far right, or making the point, I suppose, from your perspective. It's the far left. So let's get some hands there. There's one, and then way in the back after.
Yes, my name is Stefano Bonfa, and the question is, why do you do so much emphasis on AI? Yes, AI is a technology. It's a process, as you mentioned. I will put more attention on data. I mean, in Europe, for example, they start thinking about too much in AI, less on data, because at the end, the data is driven AI, the process. The data is the blood of all the problems. So if you try to fix data, in other words, the knowledge, then I like the idea of this citizen assembly, but should be an intelligent citizen assembly where at the basis we have the data driven the process. What is your comment? Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure whether we actually have a disagreement because, yes, of course, the data is at the core of the story that I'm telling, but not just the data. It's also the capacity, the intelligence that's figuring ways to use the data more powerfully than we were able to before we had AI on top of it. So the two go together. I don't think just worrying about the data problem is going to solve the AI problem. I don't think we know how to solve the data problem, especially because most people don't really care about the data problem. And it's really hard to get them motivated to be worried about data. I think if we started talking about attention and like frame it as, look, these machines are stealing something from you because they can get it for free. That's your attention. They are figuring ways to steal your attention. And just think about how it screws up your life. Like, how much time are you spending, like, with your kids or not spending with your kids because you're being sucked in by these machines and your attention, right? And that dynamic begins to, I think, trigger people's sense of, yeah, why is it that they're able to deploy their stuff? It's kind of a more potent spam in the world.
in a way that like reduces my quality of life, makes it so I'm not doing what I want to be doing. Spending time with my kids, being able to read a book for 4 hours rather than 10 seconds because I know I have to check my Reddit feed every moment. And so that dynamic, I think, is more likely to get people to realize why there's something to do here. And the thing to do is to worry about the intelligence of the AI in producing that response or that addiction in us.
Okay, and revealing, I suppose, an LSE bias instead of the far right, the next question is over there in the center.
Hi, I'm Stefan, and I'm a UCL student. And my question...
This is random.
But not representative.
After the end of the Cold War, Estonia successfully implemented education in computer technology that allowed their government to be uniquely forward-thinking in the implementation of digital services, and recently they've discussed AI. My question is, what specifically would you add to education in Western democracies to make the public able to make more informed decisions?
Yeah, Estonia's been extraordinary in like a wide range of technology technological capabilities. And I do think education is important. I don't think education is enough. Because just think about how you're educated right now. Right? You're educated in a context where already you are suffering under infrastructure that's stopping you from learning, right? The machines that you hold in your hands. And like you could be informed about why this is a bad thing. You could be told and like demonstrated that you really need to be able to sit and read for an hour. That's a really essential capability. But knowing it is not enough to produce it. And I think that there's this illusion of will, that like if you will yourself to do the right thing, you'll do the right thing. And that's true for some things, but it's also not true for a whole host of really important things. Like we just have to admit our humble humanity and say, we're just not as good as the AI is to get us to do things it wants us to do. And same thing with the processed food industry, there's great work done over here about the ultra processed food problem, which your country and my country both suffer from the extraordinary consequences of that as a kind of food that we consume. You know, it's not enough just to inform people about how terrible it is, because like they're so good at figuring out how to trick your evolution to be susceptible to the addiction of these foods, that we need something more than just information about this. So I think information is really important, obviously. I'm a teacher, this is what I do for a living. But the idea that we can say, teach people what's good and bad, what's right and wrong, and then it's for them to suffer whatever the market gives them is just not realistic. Or if we do that, we'll lose.
Let's take one more online and then we'll get one more again.
So David Wood, the chair of London Futurists, asks, how can we continue to protect the deliberations of the members of citizens' assemblies when vested interests will be desperate to penetrate their thinking processes to alter their judgments?
Yeah, so it's a great echo from the first question. It will be hard, but it's not hard. It's not impossibly hard, right? So it will be hard in the sense that, first of all, you select a random group of people nobody knows in advance who you're selecting. That random group of people, you're going to have, just like with a jury, a filter to make sure that you're not have a bunch of interested parties in the group. So you filter out those people. And then depending on the issue and your fear about, interest wanting to penetrate, you could isolate them, take them into a place, give them a week's vacation in some really beautiful place. I mean, people talk about the French Citizen Assembly and why that's so amazing. Well, they met in Paris almost every month. Like, of course, they're going to succeed in that. But, we can't offer Paris or London. But if you make it so that you place them in a context where you can protect the information flow to them, you got to worry about protecting the information flow to them. And then they finish their work and they disappear. So it's not like there's an ongoing need to have a relationship with them the way there is an ongoing need to have a relationship with representatives or even academics. So I think that I'm not denying it's a problem, and I'm not asserting it's an easy problem, but I do think it's a tractable problem, and we have lots of experience, especially from Jim Fishkin's work, about how to do it effectively.
Okay, so we have one last question, and I'm sorry I was going to, but I'm reserving it for an LSE student. You're from Virginia. All the way in the back there. You are an LSE student, right? Okay.
DEI.
I knew there was one of you out there somewhere.
Hi, I'm Adam. I am an LSE student. Thanks, guys.
Actually, we're really grateful, all of the rest of you who also came, just so you know.
Thanks. What would you say to those who characterize the current American political reality as simply being far too fragmented to successfully overcome the harmful effects of large corporations attempting to engineer engagement on media platforms?
I would say you very well could be right. I once, I've told this story before, but I'm sure none of you have heard it. I once was giving a speech at a Dartmouth, and a woman stood up and she said, "Professor, you've convinced me. It's hopeless. There's nothing we can do." And I thought to myself, "Oh, that's a fail." And then, for some weird reason, I had in my head the thought of my then 6-year-old son, and I thought, "What if a doctor came to me and said your son has terminal brain cancer, and there's nothing you can do? Would I do nothing?" Right? And then you realize that's what love means. Love means you do whatever the hell you can, regardless of the odds. You know, there's a Star Wars invocation here: don't tell me the odds. You know, whatever the odds, you do whatever you can. And in the context of work around democracy, if you love the tradition and the hopefulness and the ideals of whatever nation, and I love mine, and you do whatever the hell you can, regardless of the odds. So I've been working for 18 years now on the democracy problem in the United States. I've thrown myself off of so many cliffs. I've talked to Larry about the fact I've thrown myself off another. We have a very important election coming up, not the presidential election, but a one that I think will tee up the opportunity to end super PACs in the United States, but I'm totally invested in it. I've done everything I can, but if you ask me, do I think we're gonna win? Ultimately, I'd say you're probably right. Say it's probably too late. But that doesn't stop me and many from doing everything we can. Because even if it's too late, at least we know we did everything we can to succeed in getting back something that at one point in human history was an ideal, like a dream, and I think could be again.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.